Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Monday, October 25th, 2010. I'm Sam Mentor. Yvonne Bowe is with me again. Yes.
Anyway, woohoo! You finally were able to get it out.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, sort of. Anyway, gosh. I don't know. Sam sounds like he's been... The last couple of weeks, he sounds as like his get-up-and-go just got up and went.
My get-up-and-go left a long time ago.
Anyway. Yeah, apparently so. We need to set you get-up-and-go pills, but that's okay.
I think those are illegal. Anyway.
Well, you know, they sell those legal ones. I mean, there's that, what is it, that stuff they said, that 12-hour energy stuff or whatever the heck that they sell on TV or something.
Yeah, and there are all kinds of things you can get to, you know, and I could just go and drink a few gallons of coffee, too, but, you know, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, that could be. Right.
We've got four exciting topics for you today. Maybe one of them will wake me up. We're going to talk about WikiLeaks for a little while. Then the Apple stuff, because there was a bunch of new Apple announcements in the last week. Yvonne has some news about currencies. And then finally, we'll wrap it up talking a little bit about the controversy that Mr. Juan Williams got himself into. Yep. So, starting out, WikiLeaks. They dumped another bunch of documents this last week, this time about Iraq. A whole bunch of documents. It seems like... you know, as with the last time, I think the consensus is there's not a whole lot in the way of completely brand new revelations that nobody had heard about before, but rather it adds a lot of color and detail to stuff and maybe, you know, puts things a little bit more into focus in a few areas where people were sort of like, oh, yeah, that probably happens. But like, yeah, we didn't really have any details.
Well, I think, like, for example, one of the things that we have speculated for a number of time about the number of civilian deaths in Iraq, and I think in a couple of times I mentioned that, you know, the numbers are probably pretty high. I think, you know, this provides some additional detail information about, you know, that, but I don't think it's something like. I mean, it's not a shock to me to find out it's that many. I mean, it's just that the information was not, you know, at least the estimates or the information wasn't published. But I think it was, at least to anybody with a brain, it was a common assumption that those numbers were pretty high.
Yeah, and, you know, you sort of had the, the official Pentagon position was that they did not keep track of that, you know. And so I think the what are the final number? What are the numbers that came out of these documents? 100,000 total, including military, and then what? Like a third of that was civilian, something like that.
Something along those lines, yeah.
You know, and so yeah, we're talking a lot of people killed over the course of this. But I think some of the more interesting things are, yeah, there was some on how even after the orders came through that said, you know, after Abu Ghraib and all that kind of stuff, where, you know, the pictures came out of prisoners being tortured in American-run prisons. After that happened, the order went out that American forces were not to do that anymore. But they specifically were also essentially told to not really worry about it or investigate it or do much about it if... you know, the Iraqi troops we worked with did all these things. And in fact, there were a number of cases where, you know, if we had an uncooperative prisoner or whatever that we wanted to get some information out of, we would threaten them with sending them to the Iraqis or just send them to the Iraqis. And there were many, many, many more abuses along the lines of what, you know, people remember on the Abu Ghraib stuff and probably worse, by the Iraqi forces. That we were affiliated with, that we heard about some of these things and just, you know, had a semi-official position of ignoring it.
Yeah. So, well, and
also apparently one of the things that's interesting that's come out is additional detail on Iranian involvement in some of the some of the stuff that was going on. Basically, there were various factions that were pretty much directly funded and sometimes directly controlled by Iran that were involved in a lot of these things as well. And
now, there was a lot of speculation for a long time regarding that. Let's clarify that.
This is something where everybody is, it's one of those things that was out there, but sort of as a, yeah, this is probably the case, or this might be going on, or as opposed to, yeah, here are a bunch of corroborating details that basically show that this was, in fact, going on. I think the common theme here is that, it's just more details of how screwed up this whole endeavor was this whole time. One commentator...
Not that we didn't know that it was screwed up, but just it just adds to the... how screwed up it was.
Yeah, and I think let me find it. I think it was Mark Abinder at the Atlantic who summarized it as I'm not going to find the correct quote fast enough, but basically, this is just a picture of war badly conceived and poorly executed. As people say, war is hell no matter what, but if it's sort of run incompetently, it can be even worse. That was the argument that was going on here. I don't know. That seems to be the theme here. This is just lots and lots more detail going into the various things that were screwed up. Some of which are probably still screwed up, and I don't know what else there is to say about that. I think that as the evidence grows and grows and grows and grows here, there's just, it just becomes more and more clear how badly this whole thing, was in terms of, how it all went down. And the fact that, in fact, almost all of the stuff that we've done there has made the overall situation worse, not better. I mean, okay, you got rid of Saddam. Okay. But aside from that...
I think a lot of people think that we probably didn't do them any favors by getting rid of Saddam, to be honest with you. I think a lot of Iraqis believe that we didn't many favors by getting rid of Saddam, to be honest.
Yeah.
So...
I think that's probably a true. I mean, well, the thing is, it's, I think most Iraqis would probably agree, aside from the ones that were part of the ruling regime at the time, that the regime was horrible. It had all kinds of problems with it. They wanted to get rid of it. They were happy to see him go. However, as we've done in other situations as well, we basically go in there, rip up what exists, and don't put anything. Nothing is put in place that can adequately replace what we took out. So there's a power vacuum. There's a civil war. There's fighting. There's all kinds of people dying. There's internecine battles. There's it's the whole thing. I mean, a lot of this comes down, and whenever we've talked about Iraq, we always sort of end up back here, which is, before we went in the first place, let alone the side of whether or not we should have gone in at all. But aside from that argument, assuming we were going to go in, George W. Bush had a bunch of advisors from the State Department advocating a view that you want to go in, you want to make sure you immediately sort of provide civil order, you protect against looting, you protect the museums and the public buildings, and you make sure, things are somewhat calm, and you do that kind of, maintaining of order and that kind of thing. And then there was another faction from the Defense Department that basically said, screw all that. Get in there.
Get
the people we care about. Kill them or take them prisoner, and then, all of the forces just sort of went into bunker mode, protecting themselves for a long, long time. regardless of what happened the next few years, I think the tone of everything was set in the first few weeks, you know? And we'd already taken a major wrong turn, you know, again, leaving off the table for now whether or not we should go in at all. Assuming we were going in, we did it wrong from almost the first day. And things just got worse from there. And I think even when, you know, a lot of these documents have to do with the time period of the surge and everything like that. You know, some of this also corroborates the fact that, you know, things were starting to get better even before the surge because things were sort of playing themselves out. Like, for instance, ethnic cleansing slowed down, not necessarily because we came in with the surge, but because everybody was already cleansed, to use the euphemism. You know, the people who weren't of the right ethnic group for various neighborhoods were either chased out or killed. You know, and that had already happened to such a large degree, there just wasn't all that much more that was going to happen. You know, but, you know, the question here is, and I think, you know, we've got the drawdown happening there. Theoretically, all the combat, quote-unquote, troops left. But, of course, you know, the people who are left are still engaging in combat. You know, I think it'll be very interesting to continue to see whether that the rest of that presence does, in fact, go away over the next couple years on Obama's watch, or whether we get, you know, sucked into staying there longer. Same for Afghanistan, of course. And it's one of those areas where, you know, I start out with the Colin Powell, you know, you break it, you bought it kind of thing where, you know, at the beginning, if we screwed it up, we should fix it. We should take responsibility for what's there, make sure we leave it better than we came, whatever. But, you know, we've got so many years of not doing anything close to that, plus no political will whatsoever to engage in the level of engagement that you would have to actually fix anything or change anything long term. Yeah, it's just get the fuck out, you know, both there and Afghanistan. It's like, you either do it right or you don't do it at all. And we're just screwing everything up. So it's better not to bother at all.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I mean, we've drawn down from Iraq, left the number of advisors, which, well, I mean, I don't know if we'll ever
it's not
get
just
rid of
advisors.
All.
There's still a lot of troops there. I mean, they're not combat troops.
But the troops are not in a – they're not combat troops.
No, yes, they are. I've seen interviews with people who are still there who resent the fact that when Obama pulled the rest out, he's like, there are no combat troops left. The people who are left are in the same kind of brigades with the same kind of training, with the same kind of things. The difference is – you know, what their supposed mission is. But nevertheless, they are getting attacked on a regular basis and they fight back on a regular basis. They are engaged in combat. These aren't just like sort of, you know, peaceful advisors showing people how to do their farming correctly or whatever. You know, we aren't at that stage. I mean, and you know, so it's a play on words in order to say, you know, okay, some of these troops were combat troops and some of them were not. It's not that everybody we've left there are sort of, you know, the kind of back office people you think of as non-combat. No, these are trained people with guns who are all about, you know, defending and fighting and blah blah blah. For the most part, the people who are doing the kind of work, the other kind of work, you know, are civilians or contractors or whatever, that kind of stuff. And there's a significant amount of presence of that too, including the paramilitary type contractors as well are still, you know, have a presence. So, you know, anyway. Sorry, go ahead.
Anyway. No, what I was just going to say, it's just that, you know, I mean, I think that will continue to wind down as time elapses. I mean, that's all I said. I mean, you know.
So I'll, before we wrap up this topic, I'll just point out one other thing. I meant to do a blog post on this, but I didn't get a chance. So I'll point people to an article. It was on Huffington Post, posted October 22nd, looks like 5:56 p.m. My cousin Heather Herbert, who's executive director of the National Security Network, had an article, WikiLeaks Wars Misbegotten Hell, that talks a bit about the same issues that we were just talking about. You know, and so anyway, I'll just point people to that. Worth a read. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk about some of the new Apple announcements this last week.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And here we are, all ready to talk about Apple and
the announcement, the lion announcement,
and there are a few other things here. Let's see if we can. I'll run down a quick list. They announced a preview of macOS Lion, which is due to launch next year sometime. They announced a new MacBook Air. They announced a new version of iLife. They announced a Macintosh version of FaceTime. Although it was related to the Lion stuff, they said actually launching well before Lion, like before the end of the year, a app store for Macs. I think those are the big ones. Did I miss anything there?
No, I think you hit the big ones. It was the App Store, because I thought that they also mentioned that some other features that they were, but that's more details about Lion. No, you hit all the big ones.
Yeah, I mean, one of their themes was bringing back some of the things they'd learned from the portable devices back to the Macintosh.
That's right.
So which one of these things do you want to talk about first, Yvonne?
Let's talk about the MacBook. I think it was quite interesting. First of all, yeah, the price drop on it was quite interesting. The second thing, you know, it makes it that, I mean, the base MacBook Air is almost the same as a MacBook. It's $999. First of all,
I mean,
the second thing is that the transition to flash memory.
Yes.
No hard drive, which makes it quite speedy.
Several people have pointed out that it's only a matter of time before the whole MacBook line, and for that matter, you know, notebooks across the board are going to do this. It's the only thing holding it back at this point is the price of this stuff compared to the traditional hard drives.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one thing about it is that even still, anyway, the capacity of, I mean, I know that the capacity is growing and it's parity, well,
that's what I'm talking about pricing. I mean, price per gigabyte. You know,
price per gigabyte, but still, it seems that you can still get higher capacities of on a hard drive than you can get on flash.
Well, again, that's just a matter of price. I mean, you can get 500 gigabytes of memory is the upper limit on these new MacBook Airs, I think, and you know that's.
Mucho dinero, and a lot of bucks too.
Yeah, right. I mean, and you could get, you know, several terabytes if you wanted to, you know, cough up the dough for it. You know, it's just a shitload of memory chips that cost a lot of money. And so they're not going to pack those into a laptop at this point just because of the sheer economics of it. You know, but that doesn't mean that in a few years they won't be able to.
I think the one thing is definitely. Yeah, that just reminded me
of something. I apologize. The next few years, somebody put together a comparison that showed sort of Apple's top of the line Macintosh from, you know, when basically right after Steve Jobs came back and announced the first of the bubble shaped iMacs.
Yeah.
Compared to an iPhone 4. In terms of every performance metric on the thing,
yeah, okay,
speed, memory, capacity, or everything. The iPhone 4 completely blows away the iMac from, you know, the first iMac.
I'm not surprised.
It's just a reminder of how fast these things change and upgrade. I mean, you know, I remember that thing coming out, and I remember, you know, getting my mom like the second generation one of them or whatever. And, you know, it was.
I'm pretty sure that the hard drive back then was not even measured in gigabytes. It was in megabytes.
Yeah, I think so.
Pretty sure it had to be.
Anyway, like I said, things move quickly.
The one thing I was going to mention earlier is just, look, in the laptop world, contrary to desktop world, I think it is totally inevitable. I mean, that it is the best thing to move away from hard drives to move into solid state drives because of the fact that of reliability. I mean, there is no way to ever make a platter system with a movable optical reading system to be as reliable as it would be solid state memory. I mean, the number one point of failure on any laptop is the hard drive. That is, it's the single point of failure, the most important one. It is the reason why even the original iPods, which worked on hard drive base for the most part, those have gone away. There are still a couple of hard drive models, the ones with the highest capacities, but, you know, which I happen to own one. But, you know, in the rest of the lineup, that's all gone. It's basically because I remember seeing how many I saw the number of portable iPods with hard drives that would fail. It was a pretty high number. It's a component that, you know, hard drive makers cannot make that. You know, they have improved the technology. They have added capacity. You've done a lot of stuff. They've added shock technology and done this and that. But still, two things. One, it's slower than it is the flash memory. Number two, there's just never a way that you will ever make it as reliable as something with no moving parts. So,
yeah. So, I don't know. I still see, you know, the MacBook Air, getting back to sort of the major announcement, it still seems like somewhat of a niche area. I mean, it's better than it was, but it's still sort of like you really need the people who prize that portability over everything else, because it is fairly underpowered. Compared to the other things. Still.
If you travel a lot, I don't travel as much anymore. Not that very little compared to most people, but not anywhere nearly as much as I was traveling. Right now, having an ultralight laptop is not so much of a priority, okay? I'm actually carrying a big clunky piece of shit right now for work. My God, what a turkey. I'm carrying a Dell. I never realized what kind of a piece of shit laptops Dell made. You know, I mean, I got to say that Dell laptops are just worst pieces of shit in the laptop space. My God. So anyway, having an ultralight laptop was very nice. Okay, I will say this: that right now, even on my briefcase, even because I have to move from offices and whatever, I mean, unfortunately, because I do not qualify at my company for an ultralight laptop right now because of my light travel schedule. But I will tell you that I would like to get an ultralight again. It is very convenient, especially if you have to be lugging it around for work all the time. But if it's not for work and it's a computer at home, I mean, I have a relatively bulky 15-inch MacBook Pro at home, and that's certainly, I mean, that is not an ultralight laptop by any stretch of the imagination. It's close to 6 pounds. And most people that carry it around at home, that's not such a big deal. So, I mean, it is a niche product.
I think the key here on this is the future stuff, is that this is a preview of
the rest of the laptops will have. I believe so.
Absolutely. I think you're going to be moving towards thinner and thinner as they pack more and more power into these things in smaller space. You're also going to be moving towards the flash, etc. It'll do what it does in terms of sales, but I think it's worth it to Apple to do this, even if it sells almost none, because it's doing the proof of concept engineering for what's going to go into all these other computers later on down the road. Okay, mm-hmm. So moving on. Mac App Store. What do you think? I think we've talked before that this was a no-brainer. This was going to happen at some point.
Yep, we did say that.
And I think, you know, here they go. And I think it's going – and one key, of course, is on the Mac, unlike the iPhone – and frankly, I think this is only because, you know, Steve knows he can't get away with changing it. But, you know, you will still be able to install apps the old-fashioned way and get apps outside of this store. But the intention that Apple has is to make this, you know, sort of the default way that most people think about first. And certainly, you know, if you get the computers in the hands of newbies, you know, most non-techie people, installing a new piece of software on their computer that didn't come with it is like a horror.
Pain in the neck.
You know, they don't pain understand. In the ass. They don't know what it's doing.
I mean, I keep having to go still today to do that as a favor to other people.
Yeah, and this changes it to click, 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 done. You know?
And not just that. I think the most important thing is the updates to the application.
Yes, yeah. I think that...
Because like,
One of my questions is like, God damn it, can I like somehow retroactively get something I've acquired a different way and have it get the updates from this stuff? And the answer is, of course, yeah. Going to be... You know, probably not. Just buy the new version of it with this, and then from then on, it's there. But, you know, I mean, in some cases, I would fucking consider like buying something I'd already bought just to get that benefit. You know, not it depends on the software, but
having your updates managed, making sure that you get the right patches, making sure that you know things are properly. I mean, I think it. You know, there are. I mean, one of the problems is that almost every fucking application right now comes with some sort of stupid update software.
Yeah.
Well, not almost every, but a number of them do. A number don't, but some do, some don't. It's a pain in the neck. You know, I mean, I keep getting updaters that misbehave on my computer and, like, try to install updates at not at the right time that I want. I think that, you know, moving towards that, I think, is a huge step forward.
I think it's a good model for it. I mean... some of the apps have gotten really smart, and they'll self-update and do it, you know, silently and painlessly, and I love that when that happens. But, you know, there are others that are like, there's an update available, and then it clicks through to a website where I have to download an installer and do and – like, I'm – that's just – no, come on. You can do better than that. But this would give a standard mechanism that would apply across the board, and, you know, I know certainly once this sucker is available – I mean, I'm going to use it whenever I can. And, you know, if there's like, you know, it's some kind of software that I want that, you know, there's a version available on this and then there's another competing product that's not, you know, the competing product would have to be a lot better for me to consider it instead. You know, the convenience of the sucker. And, you know, and frankly, you know, I haven't added, you know, many new apps to my computer in a long time to be honest. I've seen, you know, a couple commentators are like, yeah, this isn't going to do that much because, like, people don't need apps anymore on their computers because, you know, everything they really need comes with the OS.
Oh, that's a load of shit.
You know, I haven't downloaded that much, but frankly, if there was an app store that had interesting things to download, I would download a lot more. Like, yeah.
And if you had like charts and it showed you most popular ones and it showed them to you by different areas and things and whatever. I mean, my God, every time you want to buy a fucking application right now, it's such a pain in the neck. It is so cool to be able to like surf through those, like in the iPad, for example.
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's a thing for this. Oh, look, there's something for that. Oh, look, there's something for this. It's really neat.
Well, I'll say, you know, on my phone, I don't have an iPad yet and there's no Mac App Store yet. But I mean, if ever I'm sitting there somewhere and I'm bored, I just go to the freaking App Store to see if there's something that'll, you know, that I can spend a buck or two on that'll entertain me for a little while, you know? And so, I'll admit my app buying has slowed down since I initially got the phone. or since, you know, I mean, at first I was like, they're getting new things all the time. Now it's maybe once every week or two. But, you know, still, like, I get new things on a regular basis. And, you know, if I had this kind of app store on the Mac, I would poke around in there occasionally. And now I'll be honest, my usage is moving, you know, more and more away from my desktop for a variety of reasons. But I would still check it out for sure. And there's like certainly like even things like Microsoft Office and stuff. If it was available on there, I would do my click, click, click and spend my $100 on Office, you know, faster than I would do other stuff. I mean, you know, there's a new version of Office coming out in the next month or so. I will probably get it. I would much prefer it if I could just click a couple buttons here and have it, as opposed to, you know, go and get it somewhere or order it or install it with disks and blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. So, let's
take a break.
So I got your chart. By the way, I got your chart. Now... I did notice it was only going back to 2000.
Yeah, the chart I have here, and that is the original iMac, was 2000. It was 10 years ago.
Really? I thought it was a little older than that.
Maybe slight. No, the picture looks like the first one because it still has the hockey puck. But anyway, I just want to say where I got this from. I got this from a website called ObamaPacMan.com. I don't know if they originated it because I saw this a whole bunch of other places over last week. This was posted on September 23rd, actually. So it's a little old. But
okay, can I please say that – let me correct you. The first iMac came out in 98, not in 2000.
Okay.
Okay, so this is not the original iMac. This is like Rev 2 or something. Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Oh, so, and by the way, I found the source. It's a Flickr user, X1 Brett, it looks like, is the...
The original Bondi Blue iMac G3 was introduced in 1998. This one is the 2000 iMac. So,
okay.
So,
10 years, anyway.
All right. It's a lot of time.
Okay. We'll take a break. We'll be back with a little bit more Apple stuff back after this.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel.
Lights, Camera, Action, by Mickey Myers. It's 1983, the infancy of food porn, and the good folks at Sharp Electronics Corporation, who have produced the microwave cookbook, have cottoned on to the extreme close-up as a selling point. And it must be said that while the lighting, styling, and overall quality of the photographs is excellent, their fetish for spearing, skewering, piercing, and otherwise gripping, pinching, and poking the produce with gleaming sharp metal utensils leaves the whole thing a distinct BSDM feel. The rough charms of a rustic meatloaf are certainly improved by the prick of a carving fork's razor-sharp points to clarify the texture of what is meant to submit to the knife. The tip of a chicken breast parmesan has been sliced and held aloft on the tines of a silver fork, connected to the rest by a thinly stretched ribbon of transparent, oily cheese. Peeking out from underneath the labial web is a layer of glistening red tomato sauce, the severed edge of breast itself resting in the puddle of clear juice it oozes. The slivered almonds are captured in the act of falling upon the buttered green beans, where they settle into the melty yellow knobs in ecstasy. The beans perspire under their weight.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org, with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay, so let's talk...
Well, by the way, as a comment, I did just buy an iMac yesterday, but it wasn't for me. It was for my office. I needed one for demos, so I just picked up one yesterday. So
was it an original Bondi Blue iMac?
No, it was not. It was a 27-inch iMac. Not the most powerful one, but the second one after that.
Okay.
What has it got? It's the Core i5 processor, whatever the fuck that means anymore. I don't understand this shit anymore. You know,
I've got the i7, so I'm better than you.
Well, you know, it's not for me anyway.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the number's bigger. That's all that matters.
Well, my boss was bitching. I'm like, I said, well, see if they got any refurbs. And I'm like, just, you know, it's like, I know how you like to spend money. Like, cool it with Owl. Fuck, whatever. I'm like, I'll give them the receipt tomorrow. Anyway.
Apple also announced the stuff about Lion and FaceTime and stuff. So FaceTime real quick. The iPhone 4s have the video chat thing called FaceTime. People were pretty surprised when it first came out that it wasn't integrated with, say, iChat or anything like that. So it was only iPhone 4 to iPhone 4. And then they added iPod touches so that they could talk to it too. Now Macs can as well, but they didn't integrate it with iChat. I still hope that'll come at some point in the future, but right now it's a completely separate app where you pick people from your contacts, and if they've got an iPhone 4, you contact them by their phone number. If they're on a Mac or on an iPod Touch, you contact them by their email address, and you can do the chat thing. That's really all there is to it at the moment. I'm hoping that it evolves a little bit more over time, but yeah, because right now there's no like discovery mechanism. So like I've got like in my iChat, I've got all my Facebook friends because they integrated Facebook with iChat a while ago, or Facebook opened up so that you could do that, whichever. And I've got all my old AOL Instant Messenger folks on there. And it would be really cool if, like, there was a little icon next to each one saying, you know, if they were available for this and if they were, you know, whatever. But there's no integration of that sort right now.
How in the world? Well, anyway, I'll ask you later. But anyway, I don't know. Facebook? We've beaten up. Yeah, but I'll get that from you later because I tried that one day and it could never. Anyway. You know, we've beaten Apple to death for a while, so I wanted to go like we had a couple of more topics, so see if we could bore the rest of our audience to death today.
I just want to mention one more thing on Apple, and then I'll let you move on, which is that really. The aside from the App Store, the only other thing they really talked about much on Lion was sort of some enhancements to like Exposé and window management, which looked like they were okay, and then a new like full screen mode that a lot of the iLife applications are also getting this new full screen mode, and you know this is something that Jobs has like had a thing for like ever. Like in original OS X betas, there was like a single app mode that would have one app open at a time and sort of that's all you could see. And the full screen mode is just an evolution of that. And like, I could see the benefit for a few things that you might be doing. But for the most part, you know, I'm like, this is one of the things that I like about a desktop OS versus you know, something like the iPad that really is single app at a time focused or the iPhone is that I've got a big ass screen. I've got a lot of real estate. I can have several things going at the same time and on the screen at the same time. And for the most part, I don't want a full screen mode. I mean, there are a few exceptions, but for the most part, I want my freaking windows. I want to be able to control their size, you know?
I understand that. I think but I could see how if you're editing a picture, for example, or maybe you're editing a video and you're trying to look at the specific details for something, or you're working on a document, for example, that you're writing. There could be certain times where, damn it, I want to use all the fucking real estate on this thing. I don't want anything else to be bothering me except this.
Yeah, I can see. I'll tell you, as long as they provide it as an option, no big deal.
Sure.
What I worry about What I worry about is when they set up the app that only works in that mode. And, you know, there's some games that do that right now. But for the most part, regular apps don't do that right now. Regular apps, even if they let you go into some sort of full screen mode, let you have a windowed mode as well. And, yeah, sure. I just worry once they start dropping the windowed mode because that would piss me off. Because, like, I like, you know, yes, you are absolutely right. There are a few situations where you want to make sure that you are using all the real estate you have and you're concentrating on that thing and blah, blah, blah. But most of the time, even if I'm editing a freaking picture, I want my like little instant messenger thing with who's online over in the corner. I want to see my clock in the corner. I want to see, you know, I want to be able to drag and drop from my desktop somewhere. You know, I want to be able to do all of these things at the same time, you know, and so I'm not like, I see this feature. I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, it's not something that makes me excited. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Let's move on. You wanted to talk about currency.
Well, the one thing is that a new, I don't know if any of you have heard, well, I'm sure that some of you have, you've heard of it, Sam. The Economist publishes this thing called the Big Mac Index, in which they show the cost of a Big Mac in different places across the world and how over or under valued a currency would be based on that, okay? So, you know, the United States is in the middle, okay? All right, so a Big Mac, according to this, is worth $3.71, okay, right now in the United States. The country with the most expensive currency, what would you think? Let's say, all right, Mr. Minter, take a guess.
So the currency...
Yeah, where would it be the most expensive? Where would it cost you the most U.S. dollars to purchase a Big Mac?
Japan.
No, it's actually Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
At $6.78 for a Big Mac. As a matter of fact, Japan right now, it's only $3.91.
Oh, okay.
Versus $3.71 US. But the second one, which I know because I've been in Brazil last year, my God, it's so expensive, is Brazil. $5.26 to buy a damn Big Mac, okay, in Brazil. The Euro area at $4.79, okay. Canada at $4.18, Japan at $3.91, the United States at $3.71. Now, the one thing is that the one that is a standout on here, okay, near the bottom, is guess which country at the bottom?
China.
That's exactly right. $2.18. I mean, according to this, it's one of the things they're talking about, you know, how people have been talking about how the Chinese keep the yuan artificially, you know, disinflated. This actually suggests right now that the yuan is undervalued by approximately 40%. Okay, let me give you some of the feedback about what some countries have complained. Brazil, for example, itself was complaining. They said that the tensions caused by such misalignments prompted Brazil's finance minister Guido Mantega to complain last month that his country was a potential casualty of a currency war. Okay, and the reason they're talking about is that the Chinese, because they are holding so much U.S. dollar, so many U.S. dollars, approximately, I think, in their foreign reserves, about $1.5 trillion, if I remember correctly, about $1.6 trillion. They've been going around and they've been pushing and shoving some currencies up and down using that money. One of them, the yen. Now, the Japanese got pissed off because the Japanese themselves also have over $1 trillion in reserves. But they're pissed off because here's the problem. The Japanese debt is publicly traded, and any foreigner can buy Japanese debt, but not so the Chinese debt. So the Japanese were getting really ticked off because they're like, you know, what the fuck? These guys are going around and pushing our currency up artificially because obviously it's a advantage to the Chinese for the Japanese yen to be more expensive. And yet, you know, nobody else can go around and purchase Chinese debt and do so. So there were a lot of countries very pissed off about this whole thing and some of the implications about it. So I thought it was quite interesting how the difference was. I mean, the main outlier here is just how cheap China is. I mean, it's just unreal. It's $2.18, and this is not a fucking Big Mac in the middle of nowhere. No, this was in Shenzhen, in Beijing, you know, in their big towns. This is not like it's influenced by it being bought out in the sticks. Okay, so anyway, so I thought that was just quite interesting that index came out and pointed out just how devalued the Chinese currency is.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back talking a little bit about the little Juan Williams controversy stuff.
Juanito!
And we'll be back after this.
What do you get when two housewives produce an online poetry journal? Poems celebrating dishwater, breastfeeding, and lunar phases? Quick trips to the pool boy? Maybe. But they like to believe they offer much more than that. There's no telling what you'll get at the No-Tell Motel. But I hear sneaking out and keeping everything hush-hush is kind of sexy. And they're hot for discretion. Having it all keeps our two housewives awfully busy, so they like to stop and smell the posies, spend quality time with their poets. Which is why their rendezvous lasts a full 7 days, a new poem each weekday. Each year they slip their room key to 52 poets and indulge in 260 poems. Their spouse's misfortunes are your gains. Meet with them daily at notellmotel.org. They'll be in room 5C, sipping the latest cocktail recommended in Martha Stewart's Living, Scribbling Marginalia.
Okay, Juan Williams. So, Yvonne, what did this guy do?
Well, Juan went and made a comment that, I mean, I actually read the, you know, pretty much tried to read around the entire thread of where he was talking about, where he was saying that sometimes when he got on a plane, he felt a little bit uncomfortable if he saw somebody in Muslim garb. Now, he couched it with a whole bunch of things in front of it and afterwards.
Yep.
But still, NPR took very offended to the comment. Thought that it affected his objectivity as a news reporter, and promptly fired him.
And then 24 hours later, he was hired by Fox News.
Now, he always had been at Fox News.
He's been a Fox News commentator for a while, yes. But he's been brought on in a greater role or whatever. Now, I have a couple thoughts on this. One is, first of all, as many people have pointed out, and I think he himself would acknowledge, actually, to be honest, this is the fear that he describes himself having is an irrational fear.
I think he mentioned that it was.
Because you know, fundamentally, let's say there is, you know, a devout, radical, violent Muslim type who's deciding that they're going to take out a plane or whatever. Guess what? They're not going to dress
probably
in a way
not
that makes
be...
that obvious. They're not going to be wearing, you know, stereotypical Arab garb and a big fucking sign saying, hey, I'm a terrorist. They're going to do their damnedest to blend in. And in fact, if you look, for instance, at the 9/11 hijackers and such,
I think they were flying first class.
But they were all wearing typical Western outfits. You would not have picked these people out from a crowd, you know?
Yep.
And that's been the case for every incident that has occurred, you know, at any time recently. You know, it would serve no purpose. Also, you know, so frankly, the people who you see who are dressed up in, like, you know, what you would consider, you know, sort of stereotypical outfits are probably the most, you know, peaceful, wanting to get along kind of folks out there who, you know, are proud of their religion or whatever, but aren't going to be, you know, doing anything crazy. You know, and there's what's the website that popped up this week? Muslims Wearing Things, I think is what it's called. You know, which just has, you know, all kinds of pictures, of course, of Muslims wearing things. And just about any type of any type of thing you would see anybody, you know, wearing, and pointing out that, of course, this is completely wrongheaded. Having said that, going back to Juan Williams' comments, unless he was saying that they wanted to advocate doing something based on this or whatever, you know, really, it seems like, you know, this is the same kind of thing as somebody saying, you know, he's admitting to a stereotype that he has. It sounds like he was admitting it in such a way that he acknowledged that, you know, it wasn't necessarily reliable. I could be wrong about that.
It seems like
expressing self-awareness of, you know, a reality, as opposed to expressing, you know, some sort of, you know, pernicious view here. Now, it's exposing him to be stupid. You know, it's exposing him to, you know, perhaps, you know, acting on unfounded emotions, or, you know, rather than being rational about such things. But, you know, I'll be honest here, and I don't think that specific thing necessarily, but there are lots of things that I have emotional reactions to that my intellectual self knows is full of shit, you know? And, you know, like, I don't know. And this seems to fall into that category. Now, I don't know. Maybe I could be wrong. Maybe this guy was explicitly, you know, exposing himself as, you know, a racist of some sort, or a culturalist, or however you want to say it, you know, being anti-Muslim. I just don't think that's really what was going on. I don't know.
I do think that NPR overreacted in dismissing him.
Well, there are a number of
that's been my
there are a number of folks who have said they think NPR was just waiting for an excuse to can him anyway, because they didn't like that he was on Fox to begin with.
Well, I agree, but still, anyway, I don't like. I mean, fine. So he was, then can him for that. But, you know, I just don't agree with, you know, just how the whole thing was done. I mean, if you wanted to get rid of him because you didn't agree with his views, then get rid of him.
Well, but
you know,
and also
don't use that as.
I'll add one additional part to that is, like, from an organization that has commentators on, one of the things I look to from there is that they have commentators with different viewpoints. And I want them to have some commentators with viewpoints I drastically disagree with. That's how you learn, you know. So I think, you know, any organization weakens themselves by dropping someone the first time they say something that, you know, is controversial, or that a lot of people consider to be repugnant or whatever. And I'll add to this, you know, it's not just this guy, you know, through the years, there have been tons of these where, you know, some commentator has gotten themselves in hot water for saying something, usually something racist or ignorant in some way or another. And, you know, the next day they're out on their ass. And I think in most cases, those are overreactions. And it's not, you know, you sort of, I don't know, if people put it as you're giving a platform to a racist or whatever, you're giving a platform for people to exchange viewpoints. And if some viewpoints, any viewpoints, even if they're repugnant to a lot of people, become sort of completely, you know, off limits, then all you're doing is diminishing the value of that platform.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Those are my thoughts on that. And meanwhile, of course, you know, Juan Williams is laughing his ass to the bank. He got a multi-million dollar payoff from NPR, and he's got a brand spanking new contract with Fox to give him a lot more time on there than he ever had, and undoubtedly a lot more money, too. So, you know, all this worked out great for him. So, you know, whatever.
I got fired.
For anybody looking for it, by the way, I got the URL. It's muslimswearingthings.tumblr.com. Of course, Tumblr is TUMBLR.com. And, yeah, there are a bunch of posts there of various Muslims wearing various things. So right now they've got the most recent one is, you know, Malcolm X, you know, in a hat and a nice watch and a ring and stuff like that. Then you've got some more traditional sort of what you think of females, Arabs wearing. And then you've got some, you know, Arab singer or Muslims. I shouldn't be saying Arab. These are Muslims in fishnets and some pearls and, you know, all kinds of stuff, you know, suits and ties, all kinds of creative outfits. One of my favorites of this that was pointed out, of course, is the person who was Prince Abdullah of Jordan, who is now King Abdullah II of Jordan, in 1996, mm-hmm. wearing a Starfleet uniform when he was a guest on an episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Because he was a Trek fan, and he got a role as like a, he got a walk-on role where he got to go onto the bridge and hand the captain something or something like that.
Isn't that great? I would have never thought.
Anyway,
we have
killed another episode of Curmudgeon's Corner. So it's time
basically to basically annihilated. Yep.
Yeah. It's time to say goodbye. Should we sing? No, we should not sing. Thank you for joining us. As usual, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, email me at abulsme@abulsme.com. That's ABULSME. Otherwise, tell your friends to listen and tune in again next week. And we'll see you then. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.